Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. Today we are welcoming a new contributor to the show, Amanda Moore, an Austin attorney, book reviewer, and writer. She interviewed Margaret A. Burnham, author of By Hands Now Known, Jim Crow's Legal Executioners.
So today I have the privilege of interviewing Margaret Burnham. She is the founding director of the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project of Northeastern University. She is a former civil rights lawyer, a defense attorney, and judge. Margaret was nominated by President Biden and confirmed by the U.S. Senate to serve on the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Review Board. She has written an incredible book called By Hands Now Known, Jim Crow's Legal Executioners. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Amanda. It's really my great pleasure to be here.
Awesome. If you don't mind, would you mind giving our listeners just like a brief summary of the book before we get into it, so they kind of have a preview of what's to come?
Sure. Thanks, Amanda, for that question. This book emerged from a project that I began in 2007. I was at that point looking at cases from the traditional civil rights era, 1954 to 1967, that had been bypassed or improperly adjudicated in the courts. And a group of journalists and lawyers were reexamining those cases with a view to possible re-prosecution, reopening the cases. And so I joined in that effort, and I quickly realized that there was a period of time when violence was rampant across the Jim Crow South, and that cases from that era had not actually been re-examined. And so I turned my attention away from the 54-67 period, others have concentrated on that era, and began looking at cases from the 1930s and the 1940s, where family members had not yet had any attention, public attention, really no attention by scholars to what it was that they had endured. And out of that work came two products, as it were. One is the book, which we'll talk about this morning, and the other is an archive of 1,000 cases from the period 1930 to 1954, and from the former states of the Jim Crow South, where individuals were killed in acts of what we would call racial terror, racial violence.
Okay, and thank you for that. While writing this book, did you run into any obstacles that surprised you?
Obstacles, no. I the book really contextualizes the documents that are in the archive. The archive contains federal documents from the Department of Justice and the FBI, and local law enforcement documents, as well as the memories of families and newspaper articles, many of them from the Black press. And so, but, you know, those are that's raw material in the archive. The archive, by the way, can be found by listeners at crrjarchive.org. crrjarchive, that's one word. .org, and I urge folks to go and take a look. So the book really tries to put the material in a broader context, tries to explain why law failed, what the legal sequelae of these incidents actually looked like, the role of the federal government, and perhaps most importantly, the resistance and protest and acts of liberatory justice that took place during this era and that paved the way for the later civil rights movement that is so well known.
And that actually leads into my next question. In the book, you explore the racial tensions in bus transportation with references of what we call micro protests by bus passengers in the 1940s and 50s. What do you feel was the reason behind why the federal government didn't want to intervene in an investigation of these crimes when American soldiers were being severely injured or even killed in some time?
Yes, thanks, Amanda. So one of the chapters of the book, I title it Soldiers and Buses, does look at the experiences of soldiers coming into southern cities, many of them from the north, many from other places in the south, and encountering very, very strict Jim Crow rules, which they thought, and rightly so, were contrary to the mission that they had signed up for, which was to bring democracy to the world. And so they would resist in various ways, some subtle, some not so subtle. And as a consequence, many of them pay, some with their lives, for protesting, not only on their own behalf, not only to assert their own humanity and their own patriotism, as it were. Here they were dressed in the uniform of the United States, but as well, they were protesting on behalf of the African Americans who had for a long time protested themselves, but now felt somewhat emboldened because here were their young men coming into their towns, looking really sharp and determined and courageous, and then being subjected to these humiliating Jim Crow practices. So the bus becomes an important site of interaction and protest. It always was and would be into the 1960s. The Freedom Rides are evidence of that. But I look at this earlier period. And as to the federal government took the position early on, the Army took the position early on that it could do nothing to change Jim Crow rules in public transportation in the South, could do nothing for interstate commerce, nor for local transportation practices. And so the soldiers were really at the behest, left to find justice in these local courts, which they did not. And so I recount the stories of, for example, a man by the name of Booker Spicely, 1944, Durham, North Carolina, stationed at Camp Butner. And this is a Saturday night, and Booker Spicely is headed home to his base. He's in uniform, riding on a public city bus. The Durham bus driver tells him once a white soldier, also in uniform, gets on the bus and finds no seats, Booker Spicely is required to move further to the back of the bus to make room for a man dressed in the very same uniform he is wearing. He protests. He says, I'm not used to this sort of thing. And the bus driver chastises him a bit more. Ultimately, words are exchanged. Booker Spicely tries to apologize ineffectively, apparently, because once he steps off the bus driver follows him and shoots him dead on the streets of Durham, gets back on the bus, climbs back on the bus, and finishes his route. That bus driver is acquitted of the crime. The federal government, in this case, the Army, really does nothing to follow up with this case. Rather than fully investigating and urging prosecution by the Justice Department, what the archives show, the federal archives show, is that the federal government went around to Black communities in Durham, Philadelphia, Blackstone, Virginia, all places where Booker Spicely had resided, to gauge the temperature of Black protests in those areas, not in order to satisfy Black protests, but rather to tamp down on it.
And, you know, many of these, there are other incidences that you reference in the book with bus drivers acting as a type of law enforcement during transportation, and that they were armed. And any type of resistance was met with hostility. These cases that, and these situations that you've mentioned, how did you even know that these stories existed? Did you have an idea that these stories existed and then the research, or you're researching and then they kind of came naturally out of that research? Because many of these cases, I haven't heard of before, but now I will never forget. And that I find that very important for people to know.
So thanks, Amanda. So on the question of armed bus drivers, I analogize this to slavery. I analogize this to slavery in that every white person was in charge of enforcing the rules of the slaveocracy. So, you know, this was a line, a racial line drawn where law was on one side and potential illegality was always on the other side. And so anybody could capture a slave, return a slave, discipline a slave, well, virtually anyone. And so what happens in the Jim Crow period is this gets translated in the situation, for example, of the bus. So one might ask, with respect to the earlier case that I described, the Booker Spicely case out of Durham, well, why was the bus driver armed? Bus drivers all over the South were armed. Why? Because it was for them and them alone to enforce the color board line in the bus. If Black people resisted the segregatory conditions on the bus, it was up to the bus driver. And sometimes, you know, this resistance was really quite vocal and quite agitated and robust resistance. And so the bus drivers had to be able to threaten those who were resisting in this fashion, and thereby the bus drivers were armed. There were security guards everywhere who were charged with enforcing Jim Crow norms. As to where these cases came from, we first started looking for cases in the Black press, African American. Baltimore Afro-Am, Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier, the Virginia newspapers, Birmingham World, both local and national Black press, which generally would take note of these cases. Once we found reference in the Black press, we would then go to see what records were available in the NAACP archive in the Library of Congress, in the archives of other organizations like the International Labor Defense and other organizations that were following these cases. And yes, we were astonished at what we found. So, you know, we think we know the rules, the byways, highways, pathways, and indignities, injustices, and brutalities of Jim Crow, but we don't. We really, really don't. And hence this book and this archive. And, you know, in part, Amanda, we in the African American community, it's kind of well known, it's established that the waters hold many bodies. And also you hear all the time, you're going to get killed for nothing, right? You could get killed for nothing back then. And so we've learned this lesson ourselves and we pass it on. But no, we thought, let's make an accounting. Let's just find out whether you could really get killed for nothing. And by the way, let's name the people who got killed for nothing. And let's talk about what happened to them and their families. Well, let's talk about the chaos that insinuated itself into the lives of these families when their loved ones were killed for failing to say, yes, sir, for failing to tip their hat in a hotel, for laughing on the line to get into a theater, for walking too close to a white person on the sidewalk. All of these cases are now fully documented. We have the death certificates. We have the photographs where family members were able to provide them to us. We have whatever DOJ records there were. We have the letters that people wrote to the NAACP about these incidents. They're all in the archive. My book starts with a story of a woman in Donelsonville, Georgia, an elderly woman, elderly for that period. She was in her 60s. She's unnamed in the letter that went to the NAACP because the gentleman whose gender or race is still unknown to us, or the person who wrote the letter to the NAACP, wrote simply, an elderly woman was in a store on our main street. She picked up a can, was told to put it down, then walked out of the store, was followed out of the store by the young white shopkeeper, a young man, who then beat her to death with an axe. That's the story that landed on the desk of the NAACP in New York City. And the NAACP did not have time to investigate, was not able to engage anyone in in or near Donaldsonville to investigate. And so that case lay fallow until we were able to unearth it, find out the name of the victim, Ollie Hunter, and also establish, although not with certainty, that perhaps the man who killed her was sent to the army shortly after this happened. That I can't say with certainty because that investigation is ongoing. But I reference her at the outset of the book in order to illustrate two things. First of all, that women were equally exposed to it, that elderly women were equally exposed to this sort of violence. I'm not saying that they died in equal numbers to men, but they were equally exposed to the callous and casual nature of the violence. And secondly, to say how easily these cases disappeared from the archive of Black experience, much less the archive of American history.
And you touch on a couple of things there as far as with stories, that in a lot of Black culture, you hear stories, right? That feeds into why we don't, you know, people at the time didn't do certain things because they heard a story. But in your book, you actually name these individuals and you have pictures of them and you put a picture with the name, made it doubly impactful for me. One of the stories that I wanted to discuss with you was about Union Springs. You have this in your book. I found this to be particularly heartbreaking and disturbing at the same time. But for our listeners' benefit, this case was about a police officer who basically went on a shooting rampage against Black citizens in Alabama. He shoots a man who he believes was interested in the same woman that he was interested in. While out on bail, he continued to patrol and shoots another man, and then 5 weeks later shoots another man. He's ultimately acquitted, and federal authorities chose not to prosecute him. Can you share, Margaret, why it was important to you to include these types of cases in this book?
Well, in part, the book and the project and the archive are also designed to address our fixation on lynching. So anti-Black violence during this period is often seen as, this is the lynching phenomena. So lynching is essentially a proxy for anti-Black violence. Now, the NAACP had a very specific definition of lynching that it used in the 1940 and used throughout. It required the participation of required a death by non-legal authorities, in other words, not the police, not the sheriff, and by three people or more in the service of justice, honor, or tradition. That was the definition. And so these cases don't, that the case that you just related, the Union Springs murders, the murder spree engaged in by the police officer, that doesn't fit, and that's not a lynching. And yet it reflects and represents the kind of widespread, again, casual, legally executed violence that African Americans were subjected to during this period. And so we wanted to trace that because it tells a huge story. It tells a huge American story, but it is not the whole story. Lynching, as commentators said in this era, 1940, one investigator for the NAACP described it this way. He said, lynching has gone underground. It's ended up in the police station, in the police car. That's where lynching has gone. And so we tell the Union Springs, Alabama story, just to show the role of law enforcement. And of course, one could then describe this history as relevant to our understanding of today's the violence that the police rightly criticized for in our world today.
And I found it really, I appreciated the references to statutes and the laws and how they became ineffective as time went on. Specifically, you wrote about criminal statutes that were passed during Reconstruction. And for our listeners, that's right after the Civil War. There were statutes that made it unlawful or illegal for state actors, like police officers, to infringe on a person's civil rights. And I think that you provided an incredible insight into the fragility of our laws. These laws came under, I think it was called the Enforcement Act of 1870. And specifically, you wrote this, and of course I have to read it, if that's okay. You wrote, by 1875, it would all be wiped out. Sections 51 and 52 would disappear for half a century until in the 1930s, the NAACP's anti-lynching campaigners dusted them off to illustrate that there was precedent and legal support for federal intervention. This law would have applied to all citizens, both white and black, but it still faded in its enforceability. That's what I found here. What do you think is the key to keeping laws effective and enforceable?
Democratic participation. So, democratic participation and agitation. Let me just say, put it that way. So, yes, the laws that were passed in the wake of the Civil War were specifically designed to control anti-Black violence, the anti-Black violence that was so characteristic of that period, and the rise of the KKK. And they were enforced during this very, very brief period. You know, the window would quickly close, but during this very, very brief period, the early Reconstruction period before redemption. But then, of course, as I say, and as you point out, they were essentially disappear from the code book until in 1930, Charles Hamilton Houston wrote in an amicus brief in a lynching case, urged the federal government to use these laws to prosecute lynchers. This was a case out of Alabama, lynching case out of Alabama. And Charles Hamilton Houston argues, this is what these statutes were for. They should be put to good use. And his arguments were rejected in the 1930s. By the way, Amanda, I have to say, this is the same time that the NAACP and others are urging the Congress and to pass anti-lynching legislation, and of course, the Senate, particularly influenced by the Southern senators, block it repeatedly. So Houston says, it would be wonderful to have new laws, but we don't need new laws. We have laws that would work. It's not really until the 1946 that the 1945, 1946, that these law, that the federal government successfully wins a case based on these 1870 laws. So it's really, you know, a very long time, 75 years before the laws become effective tools for federal intervention in the violence that has, this anti-Black violence that has swept and that so characterizes and shapes the South.
And in the book, when you are referencing the statute, referencing the enforcement and the arguments that you just stated, you also drop more cases in there, cases that are like everyday people being impacted by violence. One case was Walter Gunn. In this case, it demonstrates how a sheriff brutalized and killed a man, but this sheriff was still allowed to remain on the force. From your research, was this a common occurrence during that time when it came to law enforcement that people remain in power after committing a crime?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the Walter Gunn case, we're talking about a man who not only remained in his position, but later on was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, was elected but you continued to have a politically viable career. Let me put it that way, in this middle district of Alabama. So one of the chapters in the book discusses the efforts of the federal prosecutor in the middle federal district of Alabama to address anti-Black violence. And I describe one case, the gun case, in which the prosecutor, whose name is Parker, Walter Gunn, by the way, is shot and killed by the sheriff and his deputy in front of his wife and children. And parenthetically, I've talked about, the chaos, the storm of violence that hits and destroys a family. So think about those children sitting on there, playing in their front lawn and watching law come and take their father away from them. We've seen this again, obviously, in the Medgar Evers case in 1963. We would see this again, but it was particularly prevalent during this period. And what I argue here is that Parker, who did try the case involving Gunn, lost that case because 300 law enforcement officers from across the state of Alabama came and sat in the courtroom, the federal courtroom, to intimidate the prosecutor and to support the defendant sheriff. And after that, U.S. Attorney Parker didn't try another case for at least a decade. He would come back later on and try a case in the early 1950s, but through the 40s, he did nothing. He tried nothing. So again, so it's a system. So when I call the book, Amanda, and I see it there behind you, By Hands Now Known, what I mean to suggest is we now can fully appreciate the archive, the collection of cases, and hopefully my book will give us an opportunity fully to appreciate who, not just the systemic issues, not just the structural dynamic of Jim Crow and our law enforcement regime, our criminal legal regime. But as importantly, who it was, who the judges were, who the prosecutors were, who the police and the sheriffs were, who repeatedly engaged in this reign of terror.
You had this quote in your book, and I couldn't help but notice the connection to the title. There is a passage in which a man is kidnapped, which was actually something that happened a lot to African-American people during that time. He's kidnapped, attacked, and killed, but the killers go unpunished. The murder was reported as a death, but that was by, quote, hands of persons unknown. And that was, but now we, from this research you've done, now we know their names, the names of the victims, the names of many of the accused. And what do you hope that readers gain from the knowledge that these people, the victims and the perpetrators, so to speak, have been identified? Now their stories have been researched, verified, documented, and shared. What do you hope that people do with that information now that they know it?
Well, there are many communities that will make use of this material, both the material in the book as well as in the archive. Our first community is, of course, the families. We work with families who have over more than a decade have worked with families who knew very, very little about what, if anything, officials had done with respect to the death of their loved ones. Their loved ones were taken from them, sometimes, as you suggest, sometimes kidnapped and then killed, otherwise brutalized. And yet they have no way of appreciating what, if anything, understanding, not appreciating, but understanding what, if anything, their government did to protect them. And so that's our first audience. We are returning to the families, the documents which will explain who was involved in the investigation or in the non-investigation of their cases, and will explain what, if anything, the federal government did. We'll give them access to letters that were written, as I said, to advocacy organizations like the NAACP. Secondly, it's for the communities where these events took place. As I mentioned, the Donaldsonville case that I describe in the outset of the book, the Ollie Hunter case. Maybe someone in Donaldson knows the name of the perpetrator of that murder. Maybe there will be some effort in Donaldson to reconcile in the Donaldson white community, the Black community, the city of Donaldson to reconcile with that event. And thirdly, journalists, researchers, academics, folks who study law, who look at the question, how law goes wrong, political scientists who look at the question, how does an authoritarian state actually get built? What does an authoritarian state within a purportedly democratic polity, which these southern states all were, completely authoritarian? African Americans could not vote for their sheriff. They could not vote for their city councilor in that Union Springs case, although the man who died was well known in City Hall. When he went down to City Hall to complain before he was murdered that this police officer was coming after him, no one paid attention to him. He had no city councilor because he couldn't vote for any city councilor. So these are authoritarian states. And we expect that other scholarship and other research will emerge from this. We go up to 1954. Someone will carry this research forward and someone will carry it from 1930 backwards. So those are our audiences, and importantly, anyone who wants fully to understand how the new Jim Crow came to get constituted, what we mean by the new Jim Crow, needs to understand fully what the old Jim Crow looked like, and I think this book helps to illustrate that.
I agree. And, there were what I did notice is that you also highlighted the efforts of some individuals to try to right a wrong, to try to investigate individuals. One particular, it was the case involving Officer Sutherland. He had a reputation for torturing suspects. A federal prosecutor wanted to expose his pattern of behavior, but he was prevented from doing so. And you wrote about how J. Edgar Hoover did not allow for an intensive investigation about this officer because it would perhaps damage or rupture the friendly relationship that the Bureau had established with the Atlanta Police Department. During that time, do you believe that local politics was important to the FBI, or do you think there was another reason for their failure to intervene in these cases?
Well, we know that local law enforcement and relationships with local law enforcement were critically important to the FBI because they relied on the FBI to investigate non-racial crimes. If it was alcohol crimes or whatever other crimes there were that did not necessarily involve the enforcement of Jim Crow norms, Jim Crow practices, Jim Crow violence, relationships became important. So to ask a local FBI agent to now turn against the norms of his community, and they were all male, to turn against the norms of their community and investigate the local sheriff was asking a lot. And the DOJ knew that, and the FBI knew that. And in this particular case, Sutherland, where you have this one officer, Officer Sutherland, who actually branded a youth who was alleged to have been engaged in a robbery. Yes, and so it was a very clean case in the sense that the evidence was clear that this was unlawful brutality on the part of the officer who had a terrible reputation. And the FBI in Washington ultimately reminded the local prosecutor that we are not, quote unquote, we are not investigating the Atlanta Police Department. So we will not allow you to establish the record of this particular police officer, Sutherland, for brutality, racial brutality against African-Americans. That is not part of your brief. And so, yes, you did have this effort on the part of the national authorities to contain the inquiries of the Justice Department, even when the Justice Department thought it might be appropriate to intervene.
Did you find it particularly difficult to write about these cases? I mean, certain cases, the brutality is so strong, the impact on the family is so concrete. Did you find it hard to write about that and to describe it in such detail?
Yeah, I did find it challenging to step in the shoes of those who had lost their loved ones. But our mission was to serve them. And we did that by meeting with them and by finding out from them what justice might look like for them and for their communities so many decades after these events. And so we engaged with the children, the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren of these victims, survivors, the survivors, to help them come to grips with what had happened to their own family members and to answer their questions about that.
And at the end of the book, which I found particularly really touching, is you actually list the names or the families of individuals who you've spoken with. And if we were to just to let our listeners know, if these incidences happened in the 40s and 50s, many of there are still survivors who are young children at that time, but it really is a race against time as well, isn't it? It's your race against memories and if you're needing that information from them. So I assume the documentation that you secured through the research also supplemented the memories that individuals had. It wasn't solely relied upon one or the other. Is that correct?
No, this was a partnership. This was this was an interactive partnership. We had documents, they had memories. They oftentimes had newspaper articles that we could not find. So we would travel to places, like Canton, Mississippi, where we met with the nephews of a man who was killed in the 1930s, great nephews of a man killed in the 1930s. And they, pull out their newspaper articles and, they'd show us on their the family wall, they had framed the newspaper article describing how their loved one, a 23-year-old man, was killed by a posse in Canton. And these were experiences we had really all across the states where we traveled to meet family members, that they had carefully maintained documents and memories. Oftentimes, on the contrary, families wanted to forget this, or the seniors in those families did not want to be engaged and wanted to forget. We were usually able to find folks in the next generation down, not the brothers and sisters, sometimes not even the children, but the grandchildren were always eager to talk to us and eager to find out what their family history looked like and what it meant to understand why their grandparents acted the way they did when inquiries were made about these incidents, why they either kept their silence or told stories that were incomplete about what had transpired. So, both things are true. In some families, we were able to supplement with critically important material because of the vernacular histories kept by these family members. And in other cases, the seniors had maintained their silence and we were bringing the material to the next generation down for the first time.
And you had also described situations in which individuals, African-Americans, felt they needed to flee, to leave the area to save their lives, save the lives of their family, but they owned land. They had homes. And so that kind of gets into how there was a discussion about reparations. Now, now in our current society, there's a lot of extreme responses about the issue of reparations in our current politics. But you wrote about the responsibility of addressing this issue, the responsibility of generations. And let me just read a quote you have here. Every generation must take up the duty to repair the damage of slavery if we are to prevent its habits, beliefs, systems, wounds, and identities from endlessly rejuvenating. Because to err is to live, the business of repair is the business of life. Do you believe that this goal or duty will ever be realized in our current society?
I would hope it would be. I would hope that it would be. And hope is not a, you know, it's not a political stance. It's aspirational. I certainly know that it should be. And as I say in this book, you know, the reparations debate, the reparations discourse is not a new one, although it's reached a sort of a new level of intensity, which is a great thing in our country. But what I argue here is that if any group of African Americans is particularly entitled to repair, whether it's material or otherwise, it's this group of folks who lived through and paid the ultimate price, losing their loved ones to lethal racial terror, who are entitled to repair and reparations. And I say that because we know who these people are. Their names are buried in, they're now in our archive, but they're also buried in the records of our federal government and our state and local law enforcement agencies. So they can be unearthed, they can be named, their children can be identified. And we know that that it was our justice system that failed them. And we also know how to calculate losses in law. Amanda, you and I are both lawyers, and we know that there are 1,000 ways of measuring a life and 1,000 ways of understanding what the value of 100 acres of land was in the 1940s when Henry Peg Gilbert, who owned 100 acres of land, lost it when he was killed in the local police station in Georgia, in the county police station in Georgia. And when his family, his wife and his four daughters were chased out of Georgia and out of their small town and had to repair to Atlanta to rebuild their lives. We can calculate that. That's calculable. And so I suggest that that's a project that our governments, state, local, and national, must undertake in order to try to begin to make it right.
And, you know, with the names of, you have names of the victims and the names of the perpetrators. One of the most difficult things, of course, for individuals is to recognize when someone in their family or someone in their line has done something that they find difficult to hear. In the course of your research, did you ever speak with any of the families of the accused, the defendants, or were you approached by anyone who wanted to participate or anything like that, or contribute or explain? Did you come across any of that?
Yes, we did. First of all, in one case, we came across a perpetrator who had moved from the state where the crime took place to another state, and who had never been brought to justice on account of he was an older man by the time we reached him, but it did not go anywhere. On the question of whether there are perpetrators or relations of perpetrators who are anxious to engage with us in the path of repair, the answer is yes. We've found several people have called us and said, that was my father, or that was my uncle, what can we do? And there is an organization called Coming to the Table that is attempting to bring together the beneficiaries and of these horrific crimes, the beneficiaries of, you know, of white supremacy over the years, but also those who have participated in some of these crimes, and together collectively figure out what repair would look like for them. I'm particularly reminded of the work of an author by the name of Karen Brannon. So I mentioned that Georgia case, the loss of land by Henry Peg Gilbert, who lost 100 acres of land in Georgia after he was killed. And one of the relatives of one of the sheriffs who was involved in that wrote a book in which she talks about her relatives and that incident. So we expect that more, that with the release of the archive and the book, that there will be more of that.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you for writing a book that brings the stories to light so that we, your readers, will be able to see history told from just evidence that's been gleaned, and also from very well researched, and we sincerely appreciate your contribution to the literature here. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Amanda. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and I want to thank you for the work that you've done to bring diverse books to the American public. Thank you so much for including me.
Thank you. For our listeners, the book is by Hands Now Known, Jim Crow's Legal Executioners. Our writer today is Margaret Burnham. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.